And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
The Athletic.
The Phil Hayes Show.
Hello there, welcome to the show. The Phil Hayes Show, brought to you by The Athletic and The Square Ball. You can get in touch with the show via the Twitter account at The Phil Hayes Show. I'm Dan Moylan, joined today by my colleague from The Square Ball, Michael Normanson.
Hello.
And Phil's still doing well with his recovery from the surgery that he had at the end of April. Before he was off, we recorded a top 10 signings feature that's going to run every week across 10 weeks. So you'll hear Phil's voice on this podcast in just a bit. This week, we're bringing you number 6 in that list. While Phil is absent, we'll have guests in from the world of Leeds United. Next week, looking forward to speaking to Eddie Gray, but this week, we've got him on loan from BBC Radio Leeds. Welcome, Adam Pope.
Thank you, guys. Very, very honoured to be here.
Well, the window does open today, doesn't it? The domestic window, Wednesday, the 9th of June, as we're recording this. So it only seems appropriate that we draft you in from the BBC.
Oh, thanks, guys. I'm not going to learn anything, though.
You can sign up to The Athletic right now for a special price just in time for the Euros. It now costs £1 a month for 6 months. Sign up, pay just £6 between now and the end of the year for access to the very best sports writing anywhere, including excellent coverage of Leeds United. Go to theathletic.com/LeedsPod to sign up. Let's catch up with what's been happening. Then we missed last week, following on from speaking to Victor Orta the week before, and things now starting to grind into action. The wheels are turning. We'll catch up on the Euros chat in just a bit. But first of all, the stuff that's happening in the world of Leeds United. First things first, Tyler Roberts signing an extension, Popey.
Yeah, till 2024's existing deal was going to see him through for another year after this one. So it's a big, big deal for Tyler, who has really sort of come to prominence in Bielsa's thinking towards the back end of last season. Obviously, now in a Euros finals with Wales. And I wouldn't say it's been the easiest of seasons for him, but he's certainly been rewarded for the faith that Bielsa has shown in him, I would say. And you've got to say, you know, was his future in doubt at Leeds United? A lot of calls for him to go out on loan, a lot of calls for him to leave. But Bielsa clearly wants him, and it's a 3-year deal, which is a huge, I would say, leap of faith by Bielsa and Leeds United in him.
I think it's fair to say at the turn of the year, it looked like there were big doubts about it when he's coming into the final, because at that point he would have had a year and a half left. Questions start getting asked, don't they, when there's 12 months left on the contract? So he's probably earned it in the latter half of the season.
I think breaking his duck in the Premier League with his goal is a key moment, but you've got to look beyond that, haven't you? And prior to that point, you're thinking, what is he contributing to Leeds United? Is he scoring goals? No, he wasn't. Is he creating goals for other people? No, he wasn't, to be fair. But is his game improving to such an extent that you can see him being a key member going forward? I'll be honest, I'm not sure yet. But the only person's opinion that counts is Bielsa on this. He obviously sees a player there in him. So in that sense, am I surprised? I suppose I am a little bit that it has been done and wrapped up, because I wasn't expecting. He's probably one of the least, in terms of squad members, I'd expect to be having a deal done earlier than maybe expected. I would say he'd be one of the least. But clearly, he seems to be an integral part going forward for Bielsa. So, look, in a way, obviously in a way, you're pleased for him because you think his future's sorted out, and it puts to bed any thoughts that, you know, he's not part of plans going forward. But he really has to take this opportunity now, because after the incident with Wales as well, where he was sent home, this is the time to prove that he has, as he's told us this week, I've become a man from being a boy. That's what he said about what Bielsa's done for him. So I think he's got to really go out there and take this chance now. It's a huge, huge opportunity for him. It really is.
I feel like Roberts has been under a lot of pressure because he's been around the first team picture since he signed and recovered from his injury. But I think people forget he's a similar sort of age to people like Leif Davis and Jamie Shackleton, who have not, I think because we've not seen them as much, people are not asking questions quite so much about them. Whereas with Tyler Roberts, I think we've almost seen enough that there are doubts about him, if that makes sense. He would have benefited sometimes, I think, from not playing as much. But Bielsa obviously has a fair amount of faith in him. So it's interesting to see how he develops, I think. And partly it may as well be the club protecting an asset at this stage as well, I guess, with offering a new contract, because he will have some sell-on value.
There's a question there, isn't there, about how much it costs to replace him. That's one of the factors. And you're probably looking at, what, 10, 15, even £20 million in today's market before you get a player who you know can do it in the Premier League to an adequate standard and in that position as well. I mean, there is also an advantage, I guess, Pope, do you think, in the fact that he knows the system. I want to stop short of saying he knows the club, but he knows how Bielsa operates. He knows how Bielsa's system works. He knows what was involved in pre-season. There's no acclimatization there. He just carries on, doesn't he? So that's a big selling point. I think that's a pro for any player. It's just the continuity aspect of it.
I think that's the case with Alioski as well now. We're still not entirely sure what's happening with his deal, but it's one of those where you think, well, if he's staying on as a, presumably as second choice, because there's a lot of talk about left backs, but if he leaves and we have to buy a second choice left back, how much do we have to spend on that? And is it worth just keeping Alioski for the, I guess, because his faults are known to us and we know what he can do, that is it worth just keeping these players around?
Yeah, and I think if you compare the two players, Roberts and Alioski, I think we know exactly what Alioski can do. Do we all feel that Roberts hasn't realised his potential? There's a bit more to come. I think Alioski is probably maxed out, and I'd say he could probably max out again for another season and be a really good foil for whoever's does come in at left back. Roberts, you still think there's an extra 10%, 15% in there.
It's the ceiling, isn't it? Yeah. He hasn't hit the ceiling yet.
Definitely.
Yeah, because you keep willing him to kind of be a little bit better, but these things do take time, as we've seen with all players who play under Bielsa. And he's obviously in credit because he's part of the promotion winning squad and he's established himself a lot more firmly in that sort of latter half of the Premier League season. But do you think maybe he might fall down the pecking order just a little bit?
It's interesting because the thing that you said there about him having been acclimatised to the way that Leeds play, he calls himself a 10/8, and that's because of the recoveries that have to be made, more like an 8, as more than an out-and-out 10, like say Saez was before. You could never see him playing for a long period of time in this Bielsa setup, could you? Whereas you can with Roberts, to be fair, to an extent. So, but will he fall down the pecking order? Right now, if if we're saying it's going to cost, say, 15, 20 million to bring another number 10 in, where you think Rodrigo is going to play, to be honest, all things considered, everything being equal, then he's only going to fall behind Rodrigo, I would say. I don't see him falling any further down. So that means that he's integral then, isn't he? He's going to be in the matchday squad every week. I don't see somebody else coming in or somebody that is there already, unless you're thinking Gelhart or, somebody like that is going to necessarily take his place in the first period of next season.
Well, I guess it takes us into transfers, doesn't it? Because the window is open as of today as we record. The message coming out of the club towards journalists, and we got the same vibe from when we spoke to Angus Kinnear some weeks ago and then Victor Orta, is it's going to be quality over quantity. Two or three names. Do you think that's about right in terms of what they're going to bring in? You're thinking left back, maybe number 10/midfielder, somebody who can play wide as well, because two of those three then do push Roberts down the pecking order, don't they?
I think midfielder, though, is more personal. Let's say left-sided central midfielder, because I'm thinking more click dropping off a cliff until the very end of the season when he came back with the Storm for those two games. I think that's an area that's really key for Leeds if they are going to strengthen. Winger, we know because he loves a winger and he's not going to buy another striker, so I very much doubt. And left back, definitely. So I don't see Roberts necessarily being threatened, because I don't know if they're going to go for an attacking midfielder, if you say, or at number 10. I don't see that.
There has been talk as well, though, of moving Rafinha inside. So if we do get a wide man that then frees up Rafinha into that number 10 role. And I mean, this is the wider question, I guess. Are we building a squad here rather than just the first 11? I mean, the problem with the first 11 is Marcelo Bielsa's to solve, thankfully, rather than ours. So are we seeing just an overall general strengthening of the squad, do you think?
I think so. But I think to the numbers that you talked about as well, I think you'd see three. I mean, last summer, more was spent than I think we all expected. And that, because that included the cost of money as well. Don't forget, there's still 11 million for Jack Harrison to go out, isn't there? So three players on top of that, maybe?
Yeah.
Honestly, that's it. So I think, there isn't a first 11 with Bielsa, as we know. Mm. So yeah, it's just not tinkering. It's just slightly adding a bit more quality to a squad, whereas Sheffield United didn't do that last year. I'm convinced Leeds will.
And the other thing to remind ourselves about the transfer fees is that they don't all go out up front. So the 11 million for Jack Harrison, there's going to be part of that payment will go out this summer when he becomes our player permanently, and then another 12 months or, however the deal is structured.
Yeah.
And I know last summer, as Phil has said before on this podcast, the deals were all weighted heavily in favour of the duration of the contract, weren't they? So I think he said they didn't pay out more than about 3, 4, 5 million quid, was it, per signing last summer. So we are now sort of going to be paying those off over the course of the contract.
You are going to be triggering people's PTSD about Ridsdale and all this thing. We've got it all on the tab. It's fine. It's all under control.
Put it on the never-never.
Yeah, I think, and also I know we're going to talk about this too, but I think one thing that we're watching with maybe a little bit concerned is the John Kevin Augustin decision too, which I know has been on. You're going to come onto it at some point, but I wondered if that
goes... Just do it now. Let's do it now. You brought his name up, yeah.
Well, it made me think this is a 21 million euro deal at stake, isn't it? If that went badly for Leeds, then how is that going to affect purchases? Because that suddenly is like a huge... That's 18 million quid that you're going to have to find, potentially. And that was always a worry in my mind, whether that kicked in, would that affect this year's transfer activity?
Yeah, you wonder though, would that have to be paid all in one go, or would it be structured like it would have been over the course of the contract? So, you know, I mean, I don't know how these things are exactly structured, because it's, you know, fee up front and then another 12 months or whatever it might be. Like we saw an example of Costa's been spread over the duration of his 4-year contract. So it wouldn't be a single hit, I don't imagine, but someone like Angus Kinnear would be able to tell us that. And he did tell us when we spoke to him last year, he did say it wasn't something that we needed to worry about. So I've got faith in them to sort it out. And even if that does go against us, I mean, who knows? Expensive lawyers are paid expensive fees to negotiate settlements. So if they get a feeling that this is steering in the wrong direction against them, now we've had this initial judgment, which it is, by the way, it's in the first instance, doesn't mean we now have to pay 21 million euros.
No, it doesn't. Absolutely doesn't, Dan, you're right. And I think it'll be the first instalment that's gone in Leipzig's favour. So whatever that payment was, that looks like Leeds at this stage, bar appeal and a court of arbitration as well, still to go through. Yeah. So that could take forever, couldn't it? But you'd think that if the first judgment goes one way, that there's logically, you think the other judgments for the rest of the transfer might go their way as well. But logic doesn't always kick in here, does it? You say there's a lot of legals to go through. It could take a long time. I don't think it's going to seriously threaten Leeds' ability in the or curtail Leeds' activity in the transfer market.
Yeah, I mean, there's not a lot we can really say on John Kevin Augustin because we've not seen the case laid out yet, have we? We've not had a verdict with a full explanation. Because I think what it boils down to is what was contained, what's the wording of the contract? Mm. Because for anybody who doesn't know, football contracts end on June the 30th as a matter of, well, it's par for the course, isn't it? And then all the deals that we had in place for the likes of Harrison, Berardi's deal as well, we had to negotiate a new one. We had to negotiate with Brighton to let Ben White play on beyond the end of the loan deal in June. So that was all in Leeds' favour, that all those other contracts had to be adjusted according to the other clubs. It's a contract, so it involves two parties. And I think FIFA's reluctance to intervene with that was because you can't, in any jurisdiction in the world, you can't have one party unilaterally changing the terms of a contract, can you? So they stayed clear of that. So that's massively in Leeds' favour, that you can't change the terms of a contract to be something that you just want them to be. They have to be properly negotiated and put there in black and white. But that brings us back to what was in black and white in this contract. Did it say end of the season, or did it say June the 30th? Or we don't know, do we?
No, that's the truth. I think the vibes that you clearly got as well is that Leeds going, well, hang on, this went beyond what was the expected end of the season. So deal with that, guys. So look, it's going to go on. I think the bottom line is it's going to go on for a long time, and I don't think it's going to affect Leeds materially right now in terms of moving the club forward. And that's the important thing for Leeds, isn't it?
Do we know exactly how it's going to work with the player? Because he was obviously in a bit of a no man's land, wasn't he? And got released and has now been signed by Nantes, where he's not particularly playing. But I presume he's signed there for a hell of a lot less money than he was being promised at Leeds. So are we in then a Cameron Stewart situation where a player has left under strange terms? And are we going to potentially be footing a bill for him as well?
Loss of earnings.
Almost as a separate thing is still a bit of a concern, I guess.
That's a good point, because you remember this guy was 90,000 euros plus, I think, was his deal originally with Leipzig when he was already on loan at Monaco. So if that is a factor in it as well, then that's a very considerable factor if indeed he is earning a lot less than what he was. Because effectively, I suppose he went as almost like a free agent in the end, wasn't he, to Nantes?
But then I guess there's not a question about if he has signed for another club, would we only have to make up the difference? You know,
compensatory, if you like, rather than punitive.
Has he waived his right to get the wages? I mean, this is stuff that's way beyond my understanding, so let's probably move on from it. it's a terrifying area.
But look, it's big sums, isn't it? And look, if it does go against Leeds and there has to be a big sum to be paid out in one go, then at some point that will affect them. But I think right now, I don't think we should be overly concerned.
Are you getting any sniffs of any other movements in or out then? We've seen, obviously, Ollie Casey looks like he's heading to Blackpool potentially.
Yeah, that one is, I'd be very surprised if that didn't happen. Ollie Casey, from my understanding, over the sort of last few weeks, it's been quite clear that he wants to get regular football. He is behind, if there's a pecking order at Leeds, you think Robin Koch, German international, Liam Cooper, Scotland international, Diego Llorente, got COVID, but Spain international. And then you'd also think, you know, obviously Pascal Strout ahead of him, and I would say Charlie Cresswell's ahead of him in the list of centre-backs at the moment. So I can understand, as a 20-year-old who's had, what, one senior start since he made his debut at Huddersfield in the last 5 minutes, that he wants to go and get a good level of football. Blackpool have come into the Championship. 2 years left on his contract. Do they come to an arrangement for a player that feels that his future is best served elsewhere? And then on he goes. So I see that one happening. I really do. Are Leeds going to stand in the way of a player that wants to go and play somewhere else?
You can't stockpile footballers forever, can you? We're not Chelsea's, under-23's farm. It's different now. I guess, these players want to play, and we're going to have players coming in to the 23s, three or four, something like that, for the 23s. And they're probably going to be quite high quality, I imagine.
I think so. Now that they've done back-to-back promotions and then like the top flight of the, what we would have called the reserves, wouldn't we, at one point in the Premier League, that's a seriously competitive league that is now, like last year was, and they romped it last year. But to maintain and drive forward, then you're going to see, a lot of turnover in the 23s and in the youth system. Definitely. So not saying that he would have been under threat there particularly, because he's been one of the standout performers, hasn't he, last year. But he wants first team football, and you can get that, can't you? And if he feels he's not going to clamber over all those players in front of them, then you've got to think they're going to be around there for a little while. You know, Llorente looks like he could be supreme. Cock, if they can stay injury free, again, way ahead. Cooper's probably got another good year, I'd say, in front of him. And Pascal's just, well, I mean, he's, talk about exponential growth in a player in performance at left-sided centre-back. You know, he's not getting past him right now. So yeah, I totally get why he feels he's got to move on.
Do you get the sense from where you're sitting that you're seeing the same rate of progress that I think the rest of us are? Because we think about the changes to the board have been confirmed this week, with Peter Lowy, among others, have been added to the board. We all obviously know about the 49ers shareholding has increased in the last 12 months. And I don't know, there's just a sense of things happening, even when it comes to stuff like the pitch getting done. We're very rapidly becoming a Premier League club in infrastructure and in board.
Yeah, I think if you're looking at the board, and Peter Lowy is the big name that stands out. Lowy family have been interested in Leeds for a long time, as far as I understand. We know they've got big links with football in Australia. He's based, obviously, out in the USA now, and has been self-confessed Leeds United fan for years, hasn't he? And I think he's talked about watching Match of the Day and listening to radio and when he was a kid and what have you. And he seems to know a lot about the club, and it doesn't seem to be glib statements either. But importantly, this guy is loaded. He really is loaded.
You know? Well, which leads me on to the question, why is he on the board? It's because that feels significant to me, because he's part of the 49ers Enterprises buy-in, isn't he? He's got that tranche of shares via them. We don't know quite how many shares he's got yet, but it feels like a significant step having him from that pool of investors on the Leeds United board. Is that something he wants to do? Is it a vanity thing? Is it a wealth thing? Is it because he's got expertise in development? Because obviously they've got a background in shopping centres.
I don't think people who are that successful just do it for vanity when it comes to, I don't want to call it a project, but something like Leeds United. Clearly he's a supporter, and there's that video that we've got of him on the pitch 2 hours before kickoff, walking around with the rest of the new board members and with Andrea Radrizzani, looking around like a kid in a sweet shop. And I think he called it was heaven on earth, walking onto that pitch and looking around a place that I've always dreamed about being involved in. Now, is this the thin end of the wedge towards eventual ownership in his hands? I don't know. But what he has done for me is that he's used his business expertise. And that does include, you know, the Westfield Group. We know that, don't we? Huge properties, super Uber developments, if you like, all over the world, not least in Bradford and in London. So he's going to use that expertise to help, I would say, in the infrastructure improvements that are going to be huge. We're going to see a very different Elland Road over the next sort of 5 years if things go to plan. Is he going to accelerate it? I think he was just always going to be part of it. And I think coming through the 49ers door into Leeds United, I think the Lowy family or him has felt that this is a clean, respectable way of doing business and to get involved in Leeds United. I think when there's been other opportunities with dealing with other people in the past.
Who are you thinking?
I think they've thought. And well, look, they did try when Ken Bates was here, but they felt it wasn't right, or they weren't allowed into the party, if you like. So this way, it seems to be done in a way that he feels is the best vehicle to do it, I would say. And I would say he'd be key, his investment would be key to the infrastructure changes at Elland Road.
I'd like a penny for Ken Bates' thoughts at the moment, actually, with these people coming in and Elland Road on the verge of actually being developed, I think, rather than just seeing endless computer images of this is where the hotel's going to go, this is where the casino's going to go. Because it's basically all the stuff he kind of wanted to do, and it's going to be done better using the money of people that he sort of pushed away to a large extent.
I think the difference with Bates, though, is that it was about the other stuff first. We weren't looking at a football team that thrilled us, were we? And there's the, you know, the famous adage that Fabian Delph paid for that was the song, wasn't it? When the cream cladding went up on the East Stand some months later. And I think that was always the feeling with Bates, that the football side of stuff was incidental to the development. And I guess with his track record at Chelsea of building stuff, he wanted his hotel and his apartments down there. And he had, is it Under the Bridge that nightclub is called? And so it's just like copying that model. But these are people, the current hierarchy, I mean, by people who are saying, we need to develop Elland Road and get 50 or 60,000 bums on seats. I haven't heard a whistle yet of a nightclub or anything like that.
No. And I think the important thing is, and I know when you speak to Eddie Gray on the next show, you'll say this, the important thing is that green thing in the middle of it all and the players on it. And I think the current regime see that, not least because they're developing the green thing, and then, you know, that the players are going to play on. It's going to cost a few million quid and bring it up to standard. It's 25 years old, that.
Yep.
So the pitch will be, and the drainage system will provide the best possible surface for the players, which they seem to be keen in investing in sensibly and adding to the squad, because they are interested in providing attractive football, which they know will fill a stadium of 50 or 60,000. Pete Lowe said that. He said, I grew up listening to an exciting Leeds United team in the 60s and 70s. And so now, no, he's not the main man. At the
when you moment, first started commentating on BBC Radio Leeds, wasn't it? Been listening to Popey since I was a boy in short trousers.
Wow, the things I would have seen there. So, but I think that's important, that you've got someone football-minded very much involved along with the other people at Elland Road, because that is the most important thing. It's your product, isn't it? That's the thing that you're saying. It doesn't matter what shop, what service you're in, what is your product? It is providing a good football team, you'd hope. And I think amidst all the change that we're going to see and the corporatization, if you like, and the globalization of the club, it seems to be that attractive, entertaining and hopefully winning football is at the centre of it all.
Will you lament the loss of the old West Stand, which is where you spend the majority of your time as a journalist and as a commentator? And I say this as well with Everton in mind as well, because you're an Evertonian. We've seen plans for the new dockside ground there that look tremendous, but you must kind of pine a little bit for Goodison Park when you see that as well.
Yeah, the old lady, as it's known. I think it'll be very sad. I mean, there'll be tears when it goes. I mean, it's different for me because I don't go there that often these days. I would hate Leeds to move from Elland Road, and I'm glad that it's a redevelopment rather than a move to Sturton and all the
sewage works.
Yeah, sewage works,
which is now a motorway services, isn't it? I think.
Yeah, so I would hate that. I mean, maybe in the future they turn it round or something like that. I don't know, but it has to stay at Elland Road for me. But the West End's already changing because we've come off the gantry, which has been a fantastic place for us to watch football and commentate football from for years. And we're actually sat in the West End with the fans now that they're allowed back in, which is a great experience. And hopefully when everybody's allowed back in, it'll be an even better one. So, but the West End's already changing. You know, there's the huge benches have gone in for the press, you know, for the Premier League and the 20 observers that they have to have or allowed to have, you know, for these Premier League games, none of which turned up last season, which is weird. So people are literally going to turn up at Elland Road and find their seats have gone. And it's a little bit sad seeing those old wrought iron seats or the backs to them and then the wooden seats sort of lying in a bit of a pile at the beginning of last season.
Michael said before, they're going to end up in his garden. I think all of them.
At some point, I will end up diving in a skip in the West End car parks. I've brought a dozen seats home. I don't really know where they're going to go, but
hold that garden furniture.
It's history. It's history. You can't throw this in a bin.
Yeah, it's that's a bit sad, and I think people being moved. I mean, it's a really contentious when people getting moved out of their seats that they've had for years. So it's changing, and I've said to a few people, I think this next year, and hopefully with the fans, if not all back in, then largely back in, it could be the last year that you sort of remember it how it was before it really does start changing. So I think it's a special, special year. It's for lots of reasons.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Well, the Euros kick off over the weekend. Popey, are you looking forward to watching those? We've got quite a number of representatives from a Leeds United point of view. Calvin, Cooper, Tyro's there, Robin Koch, Diego Llorente, possibly Rodrigo, Clicky and Alioski providing the entertainment.
I look forward to it when the first game kicks off, which is Turkey, Italy, isn't it, in Rome, which my son had tickets for, but because the isolation situation now, he said it wasn't worth going, which is a real shame. Would have loved to have gone. Well, he would have loved to have gone with his mate. But so when it kicks off, yeah, but honestly, you get a bit football fatigued, I think, and especially this season, they've seen so much football. So I've not really concentrated too much on the tournament, but I know when it kicks off, I will love it. I will love it. So yeah, and I love the fact that there are a lot of players from Leeds who are involved in some seriously competitive teams too. Mm. And do like the North Macedonia connection as well. I think it'd just be, they'll be the joyful team, and there'll be that, whether it was Cameroon back in, you know, Italia 90 or whatever, they'll be that sort of team, won't they, that everybody thinks, yeah, go on, go and cause an upset. So yeah, I am looking forward to it. And do you know what, from a Leeds point of view, I think, providing Llorente does recover, he's going to miss the first game because he's tested positive for COVID, but it'd be really interesting to see how him and Robin Koch do and get a few more matches under the belt before they hit pre-season. And because I'm really excited about those two in particular for next season.
Yeah. Do you find it's a bit of a busman's holiday as a commentator? Do you end up listening to it in that regard?
Do I start analysing it from a commentator's point of view? No, I try and get into it more as a bit of a fan and watch it like everybody else and go and sit in a, you know, pub, beer garden or something, watch it half, watch it in the background and what have you, and then get up for it when England are playing. So no, I don't find it. It's not a chore.
Do you have Noel around to scream at you or anything? Or
no, keep to one. No, we better keep our private lives apart that way. Do you know what? When it comes to tournaments, I quite like watching England on my own, just with nobody else around at home. And then when it gets to the decisive game, third one in the group, always for England, obviously, then I like to sort of do it as a bit of a communal thing. And then if you get through the group, and then, so I do like to watch it quite closely.
Why? What is it about that experience?
Because other people annoy me, especially family members. I think I remember watching when we beat Holland 4-1, and I watched that and I couldn't believe it, and I was going mad in my own front room. Back, that was Euro 96, wasn't it? And it was great, and I just enjoyed that, being able to analyse, play a little bit. And I mean, I'm not a big technical nerd when it comes to football and tactics and what have you at all, but yeah, I think it's just like my own time to see how good we are and make up my own mind, rather than, I don't know, maybe jump to some conclusions or half-baked ideas that he's done quite good or they haven't done quite well, when you've sort of half-watched it and you sort of...
It's funny
four pints in.
Because 1996, I think for many people of a particular vintage, that was the highlight because it was on these shores. But for me personally, I turned 18 just before that tournament. So it was kind of proper, you know, rites of passage stuff, going to the pub. I finished my A-levels and had nothing to do before going off to Newcastle Poly in the September. So I had like 3 or 4 months of just going to the pub with my mates. And we had that summer, you know, that tournament that summer, and it was brilliant. And I remember watching, I think it was with a pint of Castlemaine 4X, drinking in my local pub in Bradford, just watching that Holland game on the big screen in the pub. So it was the opposite experience for me. But I think you always tend to remember the tournaments of your youth more than anything, don't you? So if you're about 18... 20 something this year, you're probably going to enjoy this one a lot more.
It's a good point. Euro 96 was brilliant. I mean, I was what at the time, 29, I think. Yeah. So we were
the Britpop haircut.
Do you know what? I just had that bit of a, how would you describe my hair? A lot more than it now. I don't know. It was like, because it started off so amazingly well, and there was the Scotland game and all that, wasn't it? But then we went on holiday and we flew to Cyprus. And we hadn't had our first child by then either, so it was like sort of the last holiday
The before times.
The before times, yeah, which were great, you know. So, and we flew out, and I remember we landed in Cyprus, and I literally just dumped my bag and got over the road to a pub, which was, oh, I couldn't believe it. It was full of Carlsberg landlords from England wearing Liverpool shirts with Carlsberg on.
Oh, so just, can you just imagine? What you like. Brilliant. As an Evertonian. Yeah.
Just unbelievable. So, because Carlsberg had a big brewery along with Keogh on the island of Cyprus. So we made it into the pub, and we watched the Spain game, and obviously it was Stuart Pearce's penalty and all that. So it was great. So the place was rocking. And then we made some friends who were from a Chelsea fan, actually. And we watched the rest of the tournament together, and it was brilliant. I just loved it until the obviously horrible moment when we've not beaten the Germans again. But it was that was a great tournament, and even though I wasn't particularly young at the time, that and Italia 90 World Cup, just the best.
It's funny that, because we went on our first 18-year-old's mate's holiday without parents that summer, and we flew out on the day of the final. So it was all set up. If England had got past Germany, it would have been amazing to have the final when we, it was Salou that we went to in Spain. But anyway, enough of it. We're going on this, this reminisce. Yeah. So what do we expect from this year's tournament? Because football has changed over the last 25 years. It's a far more global game. Like, you could switch on any game across this tournament and you're going to recognise players from the Premier League.
Yeah, and do you know what I really like as well? You can't cliche your way through this and go, oh, I've always got to be wary of the Germans. Well, why have you? Because everybody knows everything about every club now, because you see, everybody watches most leagues now as well, to an extent, don't they? So the knowledge is huge. You can't make generalisations for all sorts of reasons these days, anyway, about countries and teams. So I think Italy are really unknown. France are probably my favourites, I think, because they play just some beautiful stuff. And they've got world-class players throughout the side. I think we'll probably, certainly quarters, maybe semis. That's how I see us as a nation, footballing-wise, England. I think we've got a great front four. A surprise package. Somebody said Turkey to me today, but I don't know. I think Scotland might be a little, I mean, hopefully it's glorious failure for them, of course, in the group. But they're quite calm, I think, Scotland, under Steve Clarke. And I think they might just cause a surprise, and I think, which would be getting out of the group. But I do expect us to get out and do all right, to be quite honest.
It'd be nice to see Liam Cooper lifting another trophy. If it's not to be England, then seeing Cooper with the European Championship would blow out. I think it'd blow our minds a little bit.
An Englishman. I'm sure he feels very Scottish.
He is. Liam McCooper. There's a question here, I guess, about Gareth Southgate. And we've seen Calvin Phillips coming for quite a few pelters. It's obviously normally from fans of other clubs. You say, oh, he only passes backwards or whatever. And you see how he's deployed in that system versus how he plays for Leeds. I find it really frustrating watching England. That's one of the things that's taken the shine off the anticipation a bit for me, is that I feel, I don't know, do you agree that Southgate doesn't quite know how to get the best out of them? There's a lot of tinkering and like not using his best side in the run-up to the tournament. He feels like he's got his side in mind, and then he's playing players who are not even going to the tournament and saying they can prove to me why they should have gone. It just, none of it seems to join up or make sense to me.
Yeah, I think on the Calvin front, it is frustrating, because then you get people like Ashley Cole saying, well, he can't hit a 50-yard pass. Ashley, have you watched him play in the Premier League this season?
I mean, so much of our play and our success depends on his ability to do that.
Totally, totally. And so I think there's still a massive misconception about Calvin Phillips by, you know, like there was with Leeds fans at the beginning, wasn't it? He was very 50-50, wasn't it? How people were with him for maybe the first 2 years of his career with Leeds once he'd made the first team. So it is frustrating at times, but I think he'll be a real star, and I think he'll start too. But it is frustrating not seeing him being deployed to the best of his talents, if you like. But personally, I'd like to see him and Rice together and maybe Mount in front of them. I think that could really work. I don't want to see Henderson anywhere near it, especially having taken the penalty off Dominic Calvert-Lewin, which I honestly generally thought was bad captaincy. But I really would like to see Calvin certainly start ahead of him, even if Rice doesn't. But I imagine he'll slot Henderson, because I think he's reverted a little bit to type as Gareth Southgate with the selection.
I felt when Calvin came in and made his debut, was it against Denmark in that away game? Was it a board draw? I can't quite remember now. But it felt like he was, I don't know, like I say, he was being played a little bit out of position or not quite playing to the best of his potential or whatever, because the system wasn't set up to accommodate him. Maybe there is a benefit for us here in that it does develop his skill set as well, into if he has to play alongside Rice rather than being like the single pivot, as the cool kids might call it, that he learns a new skill, how to play alongside somebody else with somebody else just directly in front of him. And because a lot of England's play seems to just be move it from side to side, give it to the wingers and then hope that something happens.
I don't want to think about a time when Bielsa leaves and we have to have two defensive midfielders and we play boring England-style football. That just breaks my heart a little bit that you've even mentioned that.
Why, so, I didn't bring it up. You said
he's going to learn new skills, but he's going to learn bad skills. Skills to have to play in a worse team.
Well, I was actually thinking, because we saw him playing in advance of Rice, didn't we, a little bit for England, and I wonder if that's something, so it brings back his box-to-box skill set a little bit, because that's almost been coached out of him, hasn't it, by the discipline involved in playing like the holding position for Bielsa.
Yeah, what did he said, didn't he, when Bielsa first came, he said, we also scored 7 goals last season, and
number four.
That's you. But I thought it was a quite interesting stage to the back end of the Premier League season, where he brought Robin Koch on and moved Calvin forward, didn't he? And everything seemed to work fine. So I'm okay with it. I'm sort of more Michael's side. I want to see him as that pivot, as you say, right in front of the back four or the back three, whatever. I think that's where he's best deployed. But I'm not too concerned if he's going to play a little bit for England in that more advanced role, because I sort of think, yeah, it'll be different. He's good at working things out, Calvin. That's the thing. One of his greatest skills for me is his anticipation and his interception skills, whereas I think other players in that position that he holds with Leeds have struggled to do it as well. He sees everything and destroys things.
He's got great positional discipline, hasn't
brilliant.
He?
Brilliant. Like, yeah, brilliant. And he'll have to learn a little bit against top European players now to do that, maybe even a high level for certain games during this tournament. I hope so, the further they go in. So yeah, that's where he's different. And I think that's where he'll work out any problems that England have. If he starts, he will be a major, major part of England's success.
Go back in your mind to the end of the Heckingbottom season. What odds are you offering for Calvin Phillips being a starter for England in a major tournament?
Right. Okay, because I come at the Heckingbottom here quite different to you guys. I think he did all right.
He did all right, though, didn't he? That was the level of it.
I think he did as well as he could. Four wins. Yeah, honestly, I think he did as well as he could.
What did he do all right at?
Because I predicted he'd get four wins, and that'd be all right, and he got four wins.
Well, just because he met your low expectations doesn't mean he did a good job.
But it shows how badly I think the place had plummeted. I mean, it was a wreck, wasn't it? I mean, ever since the Newport game under Thomas Christensen that season. So, but had Calvin's level dropped off any more than anybody else? No, I think he was consistent. I mean, it's hard to remember particular games, but did I see him being an England player? No. And I think at worst, I felt he's going to be a top-end championship player. And I've probably always felt that until Bielsa came.
He's done that for so many, hasn't he?
Yeah. But I was always on his side. I hated the detractors that said that people call him hat stand and what does he give, what does he produce. I've never been that, but did I see him playing for England at this stage? No, did I see him play for England at all? Probably wouldn't have at that point. But then again, you had like Tom Pearson that side that Heckenbottom gave a debut to, scores a goal. He then gets England honours, doesn't he, as a youth, and he gets some value in the transfer market and then it's sold. Now his career hasn't exactly gone on, you know, to great things. But so I'm a little bit more benign when it comes to Paul Heckingbottom than most people are. Mm. And I always remember what Angus Kinnear said, that when he came in and gave his speech to the players, that it was quite rousing and that he's a guy that knows what he's doing, coaching-wise and what have you. So,
with the ball and without the ball.
Yeah, I'll let you say it. It was as bad as what people have made out. I think he was given a very difficult ball to take, but you're always going to take because it's Leeds. I think he's got some good coaching ability, particularly good at looking at youth players and bringing them through. I think that's where his strength is as well. So I don't think it did Calvin any harm in that sense. It's just that Bielsa's just, you know,
I was gonna
cast
say,
a spell.
That's the comparison, is that you're up against Bielsa who follows you, so you're always going to look terrible by comparison, which I think, to be fair, we have to say he was.
I think that era... And what Bielsa has done for Calvin Phillips, it almost gets to the crux of why watching England can be quite frustrating, because we've seen Bielsa take players who looked average at best and turn them into this great Premier League side. And with England, you see players going from a great Premier League side. They go from Man City, turn up for England, and they're generally fairly underwhelming. And it feels like we've watched our players just drag every last drop of ability from themselves. And then you watch England and you kind of think...
They're all playing within themselves.
How is it? Yeah. How are they not better than this? Like, I'm sure that Harry Kane is a great player. I know Phil Foden is brilliant for Man City, but when they play for England, I just don't have much faith in them doing it, which is, I guess, does that fall at Southgate's door?
I came up with an analogy, see if you agree with this, that we've been treated to like watching one of the great masters at work with Bielsa, with his watercolours doing beautiful brushstrokes. And then you watch England and it's like seeing the same players put into a system, and it's like watching it be designed by crayon. And I don't know if that is an insult towards Southgate.
I know what you mean, but yeah, big broad brush with a creosote on the wooden pens.
It just feels like we're watching, like, whereas Bielsa sees four-dimensional space chess and we're just watching a game of draft with England.
I get you, and I think I try and value every minute while we've got Marcelo Bielsa in LS 11, because we'll never see the like again, really. We won't, because he's so unique. I'm not saying there won't be brilliant coaches at Leeds again, but you've got to mine this for everything. And that's why I think this season is going to be so, so great. But I think the biggest thing for me, what powers has he got from sat in Argentina, looking at plans of Thorpe Arch and Elland Road, looking at videos of players, youth players, what have you, to see the ability that has been untapped or not realised that others haven't. And let's face it, every coach that we've probably had over the last, what, 5 or 6 years, Alan Road, that dealt with Calvin Phillips, all bar Steve Evans, said that they wanted to work with Calvin Phillips, but none of them managed to get what Bielsa has got out of him. And he saw that before he even arrived. I mean, that for me is the genius of him. How does he do that? What was he born with that other coaches weren't to be able to do that?
Just returning back to the tournament then and what you were saying before about watching it on your own. So the Croatia game over the weekend, are you going to be watching that on your own?
See, that's...
booing Jordan Henderson from from the back room?
Yeah. He's really hasn't done himself any favours, has he? I think I will watch on my own actually this weekend. I haven't got any particular plans for that one in place, to be honest. And then obviously the Scotland game. I'd like to watch the first one on my own. Although I'll get disturbed by wife and daughter, I'm sure. Son lives away at the moment in Leeds, actually. So I don't know. I try not to get my expectations up too high, because I do think if we are, like I said a little bit earlier, a sort of quarterfinals-y stroke semis sort of mission. However, I think because we're exciting going forward, if it does click, then we can really cause some damage. So maybe this is the year that it happens.
It's coming home soon.
Bloody hell.
What I don't want is all that talk of you've got to play yourselves into a tournament. No, you don't. You've got to start Spark. And I think that's where your Fodens and players that can really, really make it happen for them.
So England, you reckon, what, maybe quarter semis, and we'll see where it takes us. And what about Scotland and Wales?
Probably a bit more hope for Scotland than Wales, to be quite honest.
It's hard to know where they're going to go with the change of coaches, isn't it? They don't seem to have the same stability that they had under Chris Coleman.
No, they haven't. And obviously with Ryan Giggs being otherwise indisposed, yeah. But Robert Page has been around a long time there, hasn't he? So as part of the setup. So I don't think that will affect them too much. I mean, speaking to Tyler this week, I mean, he seems quite comfortable in Baku, you know, ahead of the first game, and that there's quite a good vibe there. So I don't see them, you know, making a dent in it. I really don't. And then the other players where they're involved, like Poland with Mateusz Klich, maybe. I mean, they've got a few standout players, but I don't really see it. I'm struggling to look beyond France, to be quite honest. And I wish Melier was playing in goal. So they're my winners, definitely. But I think there'll be some good showings from England.
Phil's off at the minute, as you know, but we recorded this a little while ago so he could keep his voice on the podcast. His top 10 signings since 2006, the 15 years that he's been covering Leeds United. Who's your number six, Phil?
Number six is Rafinha.
That's interesting.
Yes, it is. He can't go higher than this because he's not even got a full season to talk about at Leeds yet, but he has been absolutely exceptional. And I'd hate him to be missing from this list in case anybody dug back through it in 3 or 4 years' time and he had gone on to be the absolute superstar that he might be. Even allowing for the fact that he hasn't played too much for Leeds so far, the £70 million they spent on him versus the talent that he evidently has in his feet and also his brain just looks ever more like a weird, weird decision on Wren's part. And it's strange because the feeling I get down in Wren is that they realise, they sacked their manager, or at least he left not so long ago, but they realise that the football's gone a bit sour there and gone a bit drab. And I think they've started to accept that Rafinha going was part of that. But there seemed to be a fairly willing acceptance of the fact that £70 million was actually okay for him. And basically, I tried to imagine what would have happened had Leeds sold him for £70 million and he'd then gone on to play like he has this season. I think there'd have been an absolute riot. And I don't think, unless his form drops off a cliff, I don't think you'd ever have got over that. I don't think people would ever have reconciled themselves with the fact that these things happen. He is an extraordinarily good player. And I've always said that the thing I like about him is that he has all the tricks and he can mug and embarrass people like Gary Cahill. But he also does the right things. He makes the right decisions. He picks the right ball so often. He's a lovely striker of the ball. He looks like he can score and assist whenever the mood takes him. I wouldn't like to predict how long he's going to be at Leeds because I think in this form, he's going to start attracting some pretty serious interest. But I felt like he had to be in there because I do think like he has been an absolutely brilliant piece of recruitment.
It's quite telling as a Scotsman that every person you've had in this list so far represents good value for money.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, it all comes back to the coin, doesn't it? But at least there's been some serious cash spent on this guy. If you go through the first batch of players who I picked, you had Kuznobo on a free, you had Snorri on a very, very small fee down from Livingston, Becchio for a very nominal amount from Merida in Spain, and Cooper, you know, just over £500,000 from Chesterfield, fractional amounts of cash by the standards of modern day football. Rafinha far further up the scale at £17 million, but still extremely good value.
His decision making isn't perfect, is it? We should say that.
I think
it's exceptional, and it's obviously a leap forward from where we've been across the last few years. But that probably explains why it's Leeds buying him at £17 million and not Man City at 60 or 70.
It does. And also, when you're in his position and you're that type of player, trying to constantly force the issue and to make things happen means that you are going to make mistakes and you are going to pick the wrong ball from time to time. But I think looking at the speed of thought and the speed of his feet and the pace that he moves at, the number of times where he does get it right and he does look for the right ball, I think tells you why it is that he's going to go on to big things. It's not merely that he has the ability to do, you know, crazy turns like he did with Cahill. It's the fact that he can actually dictate entire matches.
What do you think he's brought to Leeds?
Being dead good. I'm aware that this needs to be caveated by the fact that we've been out of the Premier League for so many years, and it's a player that we don't particularly like to talk about. But for me, he's probably the most complete and exciting attacking player we've had since Harry Kewell was at Leeds. I think he's in that kind of a level for us. And it's been a joy for us to see someone like that arriving at Leeds, because we've had exciting players. I've already mentioned Snodgrass, people like Gradle who came in and seemed to completely transform the team. But I think to be at the level we're at and to have signed someone like that is incredibly exciting.
He's young as well. You know, he's only early 20s, so he's got a lot of time ahead of him. But I think physically, he's found the Premier League a doddle, hasn't he? He can run and run. It's the intense sprints, you know, that he can do over and over and over again. And I certainly feel that physically, he's adapted and coped with the move from continental Europe far better than Rodrigo has so far. And I think he will only continue to get better.
And when you look at Pablo Hernandez, he's replaced Pablo in the team. I mean, we wish we could have kept Pablo for another 10 years and he was 10 years younger, but football always moves forward. And if we'd have had a conversation, 12 months ago and said, how much is it going to cost to get a player of Hernandez's ability and to replace him? You wouldn't have said 17 million, would you?
I don't think you would have thought either that Leeds would have found it as easy to cope without Hernandez as they have this season. I mean, he has made next to no impact at all and has barely played as a rule. There were a couple of assists against Newcastle, but they've had no goals from him. He hasn't been a fixture in the team by any stretch, but it hasn't really impacted on results at all. And there's definitely been a passing of the baton, which I think will continue in the summer when it's very likely, I think, that Hernandez will leave. We are moving into a slightly different era now, and it all feeds into the kind of mindset that you have to have as a kind of progressive and ambitious club, that you can't stand still, and when things need to change, you need to have the courage of your convictions to make them change.
Well, Rafinha takes the number 6 spot in the top 10 signings since 2006, the period in which Phil's been covering Leeds United. Kisnorbo at 10, Snoddy at 9, Becchio at 8, Cooper 7. Rafinha takes 6. We'll be into the top half of this top 10 next week. Rafinha then, Popey. Good signing? Signing of last season, do you reckon?
Do you know what? I think one of the greatest players, ability-wise, that I have ever had the fortune to see in the flesh. And for those 8,000 or 9,000 that got there to see him against West Brom, then that's a little taste, isn't it? Going forward, honestly, this guy is just out of this world. I mean, putting Gary Cahill into early retirement with the spinning Megs was superb. That and just, you know, some of the goals he's got. The one he got at Everton was brilliant, you know. And Everton were good that day too, or in on good form, and sort of the one away from home. He is just exceptional. I mean, I've seen some great players. I mean, like Lewis Cook, I thought was one of the finest young players seen come through. Fabian Delph, I saw him coming through. But talk about ability that's just on a different planet. This guy's got it. He takes the ball in any form, any way, on the move. Brilliant work ethic. Gets right back, helps out his side, and is willing to attack from anywhere. And genuinely is upset if he doesn't score, if the team loses. It really, really matters. I just think he's... If you could create a player to excite, do anything he wants to with the football, score goals, entertain, you've got it. But he's got the ethic.
He's brilliant, isn't he?
He's just brilliant. Honestly, he is. At this stage, I don't think I've seen a better player, certainly not at Leeds United, in the time that I've been watching football. And he's shown it consistently now, despite that disgraceful challenge at Manchester City that that put him out for a few games.
You get the sense he's going to be a player who really thrives in Elland Road. I think they all will, actually. I look at the list of the name of the signings, the names of the signings from last summer. You've got Rafinha, Llorente, Cork, Rodrigo as well. I think they're all going to thrive when Elland Road is bouncing again, and you must be looking forward to it as well.
Can't wait. Look at Rafinha. When the goal goes in for Rodrigo, they're both celebrating in front of the south stand and like just getting that lift off the fan. You can see that means they've had that taste now. And hopefully that means something as well, because obviously everybody said, oh, such and such are in for Rafinha. You know, he's going to go here, he's going to go there. He's probably tripled his value by now and what Leeds have paid for him. So, you know, snip of the Premier League signings, no doubt about it. One of the world's snips, I would say, in terms of football transfers. But they're going to love it, and they won't crumble under this. They will love it even more. And I think we know what Rafinha's got. We've seen the full package. He's displayed it every game he's played in, more or less. Rodrigo's the one that excites me, because I think we've seen 20% of him so far. And there, what we saw at Burnley is a top-class quality finisher. I'm really excited about seeing him next season.
I'm looking forward to them seeing the away crowd as well, because everyone talks about how good it is playing in front of a full Elland Road, but there's something very sort of cultish about our away following, and the way that we, should we say, ingratiate ourselves into opposition towns and opposition stadiums by being loud and very present and very vocal, both inside and outside the ground. But you know what I mean? Like, the fans are just different class when it comes to away fixtures, and I think they'll really, really enjoy that as well, to hear, you know, 3,000 fans inside every stadium out-singing the home fans. It's going to be brilliant.
I think it'll be extraordinary. Yeah, that's the bit that they probably won't get in their heads at this moment. They probably think, yeah, we know maybe what we're going to get at Elland Road, and we'll have about a slice of it. But yeah, I think you're right. It Leeds brings something very different. And over the years, we've talked about the clubs that have missed Leeds. They've laughed at the schadenfreude, hasn't it? That's been that Leeds' demise has caused, you know, a lot of mirth for a lot of clubs. But now a lot of them have gone through it themselves since. But there's no doubt they've been missed. And it is that edginess that Leeds fans bring to, particularly in, well, not just a home game, but to an away game. And I know loads of people have missed it. And that's such a shame that this season's gone by without that happening. But maybe it'll be even more intense at the sort of, knowing what is missed and what has almost been taken away for a long time, that opportunity is going to be presented back, hopefully, for away fans very soon. And I think you're right. They will thrive on that. I think they really will, having that support and how much it means. You know,
does it give you a platform to commentate on as well when you hear the fans in fine voice? Because it gives you a point of reference, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, the first thing you do, you try and identify where the fans are on the ground, you know, the Leeds fans are. Because
You'll hear them,
yeah. And it's always, because like, sometimes you get a bit thrown, like stadiums might have, they might put the fans in a different area than you're used to being before. And obviously there's going to be a few new stadiums which this season that fans haven't been to. So yeah, so that's the first thing you do, is identify where it's coming from, point the mics that way, so you get a little bit more noise to pick up.
Oh,
from.
Is that a trick, is it?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, so a bit of that going on. So yeah, it is. And it's the thing that we've missed the most is not having that, you know, crescendo of noise that accompanies your commentary. And that's why it's quite nice that in the West End that we're going to be sat much more in amongst the fans too.
You should get a sense of the noise.
Yeah, definitely. And it was great. You know, the other day when they came in for the West Brom game, there was two ladies came in, and it was like they'd come for the first time again. It was brilliant. And they just found their old seats in the West End, and we went down and spoke to them. And then there was guys just like, considering people are socially distanced too, they were like, scars with the heads, just singing madly, like it was the first game they've ever been to. And these were, I bet every one of them were middle-aged, and I'm not being unkind. And it was just brilliant. And they're thinking, well, we're going to be sat amongst that. It's like, sat amongst supporters comment is great. It's much better when it's like that. It's a much more intimate feeling. And it was brilliant to see. It really was. And I think that there's going to be an extra verve to the Elland Road crowd when everybody's back in together. It's going to be like starting the Premier League all over again, isn't it? It's going to be.
It's funny you're saying that. I'm starting to glaze over now. My eyes, I'm getting misty-eyed and feeling quite emotional when you're describing it.
Look, when the Championship trophy was put on the Kop touchline by the goal, way before it was presented.
For that photo, was it?
Yeah, for that photo. We were on the gantry that night, and there was me, Noel, Johnny, and Catherine from BBC Radio, I think, and Pete had done the show before. I remember we looked down and they started tearing up. And I was the one on the mic at the time, and I kept going, but they just saw, and that was before any crowd had come in. Well, what little crowd there was, obviously there was players, stuff like that. And people were tearing up looking at stuff like that. So when fans came in the other day against West Brom, it was quite emotional as well. And I think when we all do it together, it's going to be a massive sob fest and, you know, hug fest and what have you.
I'm going to cry. I've said before on the record, I will cry when I get back in there without a shadow of a doubt. Because I still... It's not the same as when you were a kid. And I remember, you know, as a kid, you might be walking up the steps holding your dad's hand or whoever's hand, and you emerge out of the gangway and you see the green rising up in front of you. That I love that sense. I love that moment still now, even now when you first get a glimpse of the grass and you think, oh God, how green is that? How good does it look? It's like the best lawn ever, isn't it? And I'm home. And I get that sense every time, but it's going to be that, but on steroids when we all finally get back in there, when you hear the noise. And
I think it's going to be interesting to see how the atmosphere has changed, actually, because I feel like we're going back to a different Leeds United than the one we left at the Huddersfield game, because at that point we were a terrified Championship team. And it feels like since that game, we've turned into we've got a bit of Premier League swagger to us now. And I don't feel like there's going to be quite the same tension there. There's so much goodwill now to all of these players as well, because I think if you'd asked people at the Huddersfield game what they thought of Liam Cooper, probably half of them would have said, oh, I'm just not sure, he worries me and stuff. Whereas now I think people would almost universally say, he's a hero. Look what he's done. Mm. He's got us up. And I wonder if there'll be a certain nice feeling of attention being lifted, because it's been like that for so many years. Well, it's gone through spells of being disinterested hostages at Elland Road, more or less. people who go because that's what you do. And it's like, here we are again, kind of thing on a Saturday. And you can still, there's been good times mixed in with it, but there was years where there was no football played essentially at Elland Road. You were going to watch Leeds.
Out of habit, yeah.
Because you support Leeds, yeah. And that's why you're there. And I think the transformation of us into an actual football club again, and an incredibly good and entertaining one, I think it'll be interesting to see how that translates, and if there's any of that old tension still there, and when we miss a chance in the first minute, people will still be going, oh, it's just typical Leeds this.
Well, I mean, I do feel genuinely like a huge weight has been lifted from, and I felt it lift around the promotion. I felt like, you know, like a lifetime's worth of tension and stress.
I think I said it felt like we'd been fixed.
Yeah.
Getting us up, it's like, right, that's done now.
It was therapy.
Fine.
Wasn't it? It was a form of therapy getting promoted. It took away so much anxiety, so much tension. Do you think it's been lifted, Popey? I mean, like you say, you view all this through a far more professional journalistic prism than we do, but you can't help but get attached to the whole thing and the whole idea. And I can tell you, just from talking to you, and you know, the amount of time you spend around the club and covering it must affect you. And do you get a sense that everyone's just moving a little bit differently, a little bit more confident? There's not quite the same millstone around the neck.
Oh, definitely. And I think the disinterested hostages is a really good thing. Yeah, you feel like you've been on tap in the radiator now, don't you? Some horrible cell somewhere, yeah. Yeah, definitely. I think because everything seems to be aligning nicely. It's the long-term stuff, you know, for the ground, what have you, the infrastructure around it as well, which seems to still be planning forward, all the Matthew Murray stuff and the sporting hub that's going on Fulham car park, the ground itself, the pitch itself, the investment in players has been sensible. All that stuff seems to be, it makes sense, and they've delivered consistently. Now, there has been mistakes on the way, we know that, but ultimately, Andrea and team have delivered along the way, and I think that's the first over a sustained period now, and they brought in a world-class coach.
Is that all we had to do, was deliver on promises?
I think it's a huge thing, whether it be, and he might have your different views on the ground too, which we know the 49ers now have at stake in, but the fact that he actually bought it, now he bought it into his own company. I mean, people get confused and think that Leeds United owned the ground. Well, they didn't. No, they didn't, and they don't. The 49ers have a part of it now, we understand. That's what we were told that by Parag Marite. But I think when Andrea did that and became a more, if you like, benign landlord compared to what was going on before, then I think that was quite a key moment. I know Angus Kinney was really excited about it at the time, and I think the council got excited. They felt like, we can deal with this club now, and that's the thing for me. We've got fans on board, we've got council on board, we've got businesses on board. Leeds are attractive in a way that they hadn't been attractive for a lot of years, other than to their fan base, of course, which will always be attractive. It doesn't matter how ugly your other half is, it's your other half, isn't it? In that sense, yeah, a huge weight has been lifted, because I think it's a club that is now capable of stealing a march, and others too, that have been in a similar situation, come into the Premier League, but now look like they can not do that horrible, you know, second season syndrome thing. I think there's a plan here that's going to move them forward again, providing that he signs.
He will do, won't he? I mean, I can't believe we've made it this far in without even mentioning that. I think it was down in the notes for somewhere at the start. There doesn't seem to be any anxiety about him re-signing, because he's up at the training ground coaching children.
That was amazing, that wasn't it?
Yeah.
How lovely was that? Yeah, just giving 90 minutes of his time for under-11s.
It's just completely wholesome. And that's why I love him so much and why he can never leave.
But I think the big point there is that if he isn't able to do that, if his ability to not bring through young players and put time into young players, which he's talked about a lot, hasn't he? He said, we need to reduce the footballing calendar so that more time is put into developing youth talent everywhere, he's talking. If he felt that Leeds were curtailing his ability to do that and to make and to not help players reach their potential, I think that would be one of the things that could see him walk, because that is, I'm not saying it's the most important thing, but I think that's a huge aspect of it. And he felt from the beginning that he could do that with Leeds, with their academy, with the setup, etc. And obviously it's gone from strength to strength. The minute that doesn't happen, I think that's an issue. That's why you see him doing that. He loves doing that. Under-11s coaching, he says, you're right, I can give my time to these kids and make them better. And whether that be, you know, Niall Huggins in the 23s or whatever, or an 11-year-old up at Thorpe Arch, I think that's so important for him. So it is wholesome, but it's absolutely key to helping him stay, I think.
It's made it reframe our expectations, hasn't it? The way that Bielsa operates has made us examine what we want out of our football club. And I think we appreciate now when we see the development of the likes of Patrick Bamford, Stuart Dallas, Liam Cooper, Luke Ayling, you know, the list goes on, how much better they've become in the time that Bielsa's been here, the longest he's been anywhere. It doesn't feel like they've reached their ceiling yet. And we now understand, it feels like we've been let into a little bit of a secret almost, that if you put your efforts into good coaching, that counts for so much more than all these managers who say, oh, well, I need more backing in the transfer market. I need this, I need that. Bielsa's is the antithesis of that, isn't he? He's a man who's saying, nope, what I've got, I will make work and I will make better. In many ways, I don't even want anything else extra.
Yeah, it's almost like he piles up the challenge against him, isn't it? Let's take an example. I mean, obviously there's a managerial merry-go-round going on as we speak, isn't it, in the Premier League, and who's going to go where. But look at Carlo Ancelotti, who comes out of it at the first chance, Real Madrid come knocking, he goes back. Look at Marcelo Bielsa. For me, Ancelotti isn't a coach of developing young players. Calvert-Lewin, I think, was doing fine with Duncan Ferguson's presence there. Tom Davis is maybe the one player at Everton that you can say has really come on leaps and bounds. I think he's a manager of very talented, already established players, and he knows how to manage those egos. Whereas Bielsa is a coach, and he's the finest coach that I've ever witnessed. And obviously one of the finest coaches the world has ever witnessed. We can see that. His track record of development players is superb. And we'll use the word project, but he can see it through, whereas other coaches won't see it through or don't want to take on. And Carlo actually admitted that, really. He said, this is the first time I've ever sort of tried to do something from the bottom up, whereas this is exactly what Marcelo wants to do. Look what he's done at Newell's in the past. Look what he did with Chile, which was incredible. But what he's done at Leeds is phenomenal. I don't know anybody else that's done this for a long time. You know, certainly not at Leeds, anyway, since Don's days or certainly Howard's in a way, but you could make a comparison there. But that's the difference, that this guy can coach and get, I don't mind, materials that just probably didn't exist in anybody else's mind, or players didn't even know that they had. I mean, that's the exceptional powers that he's got. And what it does do, though, is says if he's not there, will the same players be able to do it elsewhere or still be able to do it at Leeds? That's your concern, isn't it? What's the opportunity cost of him not being there?
But let's not think about that.
No.
At all. That sounds like a terrible thought. And let's not leave it on
that. No, I think he'll sign.
Let's leave it on this note, that the whole thing, for me personally, and see if you agree, leaves me with huge optimism and anticipation for next season. I had a week's break and I'm already looking forward to the fixtures coming out, which is in the next week or two, isn't it? And then we can start to plan what's Christmas going to look like? What's it going to look like at Easter? Will we be pushing for Europe maybe? But the whole thing just feels like, contrary to the idea of being hostages to fortune at Elland Road, I can't wait to get back there and I can't wait to watch us play again, because it's brilliant. And I know no matter what happens in the Euros this summer, none of it's going to compare to something like Stuart Dallas's winner at the Etihad last season. Nothing will match that.
I think you're right. The Euros is a nice sideshow for me. I cannot wait. I didn't want the last season to end, not least because fans were coming back in. But that 11-match spell at the end where they lost once to Brighton, I think the last 10 games, in fact, was the second best haul of points they've done in the top flight.
When we burnt out?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, and they burnt out. Yeah, 66-67 was the last time they got, I think it was 23 points. It's only the last time Leeds didn't make the Champions League, which was when they finished fourth, wasn't it? They got 25 points in the last 10 games. For him to do that in his first top flight season with that team is absolutely incredible. That's why I didn't want it to end. I can't wait. I think, look, we could, what he's done for me, like I said, he's made you re-examining what is success, what is important. Now, are Leeds going to progress next season? Yes, you can do it linearly and think, yeah, I'd like them to get more points. But I wouldn't measure it in where they finish in the table. If they ended up with 62 points next season, great. There's a clear progression there. But they might finish, I doubt it, they might finish 10th or 11th, for that say. So I'm not too bothered about that. I'm not too bothered it has to be a big push for Europe. It's about performance. And he is the coach that epitomises that performance. If you get that right more often than not, you'll start winning. And he echoes people like Tony Smith, who was in charge of the Leeds Rhinos, and Malcolm Wilshop, God rest his soul, who's a squash coach in the locality, who had his son James as world number one. They always talked about performance, performance, performance. Then you will more often get the results. And that's exactly what Bielsa's about, getting performances right. That's why he wasn't concerned with the defeat at Brighton, because I still felt we were trying to do the right things. And I think if that's going to continue under him, then Leeds are going to be fine. And I think you will see improvement next season under him.
Fingers crossed. Can't wait to find out. You can get in touch with the show at The Phil Hay Show. Popey, thank you for coming on. It's been an absolute pleasure. Always like talking football with you.
Yeah, loved it, guys. I'm a bit in awe that I've been allowed in the Phil Hay Show. Yeah.
You're not allowed out again now. That's it. You're a hostage to us forevermore. No, absolute pleasure. And try and keep Whelan in check if you can for next season.
What are you going to ask me?
Nothing more, just to say thanks. And yeah, enjoy next season and we'll keep in touch. Please come back on and speak to us again sometime soon. And catch up with The Athletic. The latest price, the latest offer, theathletic.com/LeedsPod. And we'll be back next week to talk to Eddie Gray.
The Phil Hay Show.